forward and how ready is Saudi Arabia for that step? Because Iran expressed with President Raisi at the beginning that it wants good relationship with Saudi Arabia.
Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joining us from Brussels. Farah Sanaja, manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, joining us from Toronto. Thank you for contributing to this program, and a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now, we enlighten you with verses 40 to 43 of chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. يا بني إسرائيل اذكروا نعمتي التي أنعمت عليكم وأوفوا بعهدي أوف بعهدكم وأوفوا بعهدي أوف بعهدكم وإياي فارهبون وآمنوا بما أنزلت مصدقا لما معكم ولا تكونوا أول كافر به ولا تشتروا بآياتي ثمنا قليلا وإياي فاتقون ولا تلبسوا الحق بالباطل وتكتموا الحق وأنتم تعلمون. وأقيموا الصلاة وآتوا الزكاة واركعوا مع الراكعين. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. O children of Israel, call to mind my favor which I bestowed on you, and be faithful to your covenant with me. I will fulfill my covenant with you, and of me, me alone, should you be afraid. And believe in what I have revealed, verifying that which is with you, and be not the first to deny it, neither take a mean price in exchange for my communications, and me, me alone should you fear. And do not mix up the truth with the falsehood, nor hide the truth while you know it. And keep up prayer, and pay the poor rate, and bow down with those who bow down. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says its agreement with Saudi Arabia to restore bilateral ties could facilitate a ceasefire in Yemen and establishment of an inclusive government there. China names a general sanctioned by the United States as its new defense minister as tensions remain high between the two sides. Also ahead, France's Senate approves the government's unpopular pension reforms planned despite months of protests and strikes in the country. World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us.
Our top story this hour, the agreement between Iran and Saudi Arabia to restore ties will speed up the achievement of a ceasefire in Yemen and the establishment of an inclusive government in the country. Iran's permanent mission to the UN made the remark in a statement. The statement added that the agreement will have many positive effects on bilateral, regional and international levels. It said the deal proves Iran's determination to use all regional capacities to promote all-out peace and stability and meet the collective interests of regional governments and nations. The agreement between Tehran and Riyadh was reached through a deal mediated by China. The deal will see the two countries restoring diplomatic ties within 2 months and reopening their respective embassies. The agreement has received wide welcome from the international community, but has angered Israeli officials. The occupying regime's opposition figures say it reflects the complete failure of the new extremist cabinet's foreign policy. It's been hailed as a diplomatic breakthrough. Iran and Saudi Arabia have restored ties after 7 years. The announcement was made by China, which has played a significant role in making the agreement possible. And this is certainly bad news for the US, which has lost its standing in West Asia, and also for Israel, that was hoping to lure Saudi Arabia away from Iran. We'll be right back.
trilateral meetings in progress in the capital, Beijing. The participants: Saudi Arabia's National Security Advisor, Mossad bin Mohammed al-Aban, Iran's Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, and Wang Yi, Director, Office of Foreign Affairs Commission, the Communist Party of China Central Committee. Then came the announcement. After 7 years, Iran and Saudi Arabia have resumed diplomatic ties. Meanwhile, Ali Shamkhani expressed willingness to continue constructive dialogue, fully implement their consensus, and enhance good neighborliness to jointly safeguard regional security.
At the end of the talks, we reached a decision to start a new chapter after 7 years of severed relations between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Saudi Arabia. While considering the interests of the two countries, the security and well-being of the region, and preventing undue intervention from extra-regional forces, particularly from the West, and constant mischief by the Zionist regime in the region. We hope that this new chapter will compensate for the stagnation of relations over these last 7 years and also lead to stability and security in the region, as well as the improvement of the welfare of all its people.
Saudi Arabia was also positive in its assessment of what this deal means. When it comes to the agreement itself, this is what we know. Both have agreed to restore diplomatic relations. This will be followed up by the reopening of embassies and missions within a period not exceeding 2 months. Per protocol, this means the exchange of ambassadors. The two countries agreed to implement the Agreement on Security Cooperation signed on April 17, 2001, and the General Agreement reached on May 27, 1998, aimed at fostering ties in economic, commercial investment, technical, and scientific fields, to name a few.
Saudi Arabia, however, has been a bad actor when it comes to issues that are important for Iran. It's waged a bloody war in Yemen, which it's not been able to win. It was responsible for the execution of powerful cleric Sheikh Nimr Baqir in Nimr. Also, when it comes to the Palestine cause, it's failed to support the Palestinians against Israel. And for years, it's backed the Daesh terrorists in the war on Syria.
Since the announcement of the restoration of ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia, there's been a tidal wave of responses and reactions. The U.S. President Joe Biden's response was clearly off the mark. He said better relations between Israel and their Arab neighbors are better for everybody. As for Israel, the opposition has been quick to react and has slammed Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. They said the restoration of diplomatic ties between Saudi Arabia and Iran represents a failure of foreign policy by Israel's longest-serving prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. There's no doubt, however, that this is seen as a major defeat for the U.S. and its standing, especially when it comes to diplomacy. Mark Dubowitz, the chief executive of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, has said, "Lose, lose, lose for American interests." This agreement demonstrates the Saudis don't trust Washington to have their back. Iran sees opportunity to peel away U.S. allies to end international isolation. Although this may be a huge diplomatic victory for China, this is also a victory of Iranian policy when it came to Yemen and Saudi Arabia itself. Let's not forget, this was a face-saving deal for the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, since his Yemen policy was defeated due to the Ansarullah movement's dominance in Yemen. Saudi Arabia was also defeated in Syria when it backed Daesh terrorists with the help of his allies, like the U.S. Other issues leading to the severance of diplomatic ties included how Saudi Arabia executed prominent Shiite cleric Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr. Saudi Arabia was also responsible when it led Persian Gulf Arab monarchies to blacklist the Lebanese resistance group Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. Saudi's past behavior shows that it cannot be a trustworthy partner until certain actions are taken when it comes to issues like Yemen, Palestine, and Syria, where it has played destructive roles. It remains to be seen whether this agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran to ensure the security of West Asia would translate into a decrease of the U.S. presence in the region to its eventual withdrawal completely.
Tehran has finalized the deal to buy Sukhoi Su-35 fighter jets from Russia. That's according to Iran's permanent mission to the United Nations. Tehran began approaching countries to buy fighter jets in order to replenish its air fleet. The deal was finalized after Moscow expressed readiness to sell the aircraft to Tehran. This following the expiration of United Nations restrictions on Iran's purchasing of conventional weapons. The UN had retained an arms embargo on the Islamic Republic for 5 years, since 2015. That was when the world body endorsed the Iran nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. Due to U.S. sanctions, the Iranian Air Force was struggling to acquire spare parts to keep its warplanes in the air. The Islamic Republic has managed to develop its own domestic aerospace industry despite such measures. Meanwhile, Iran has unveiled and opened the mass production line for a new domestically developed training jet. Gisu Mish Ahmadi has the details.
A ribbon-cutting ceremony to go down in history, opening the production line of Iran's first homegrown jet trainer, Yasin. According to Iran's Defense Minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani, the jet trainer is capable of carrying out combat missions as well as other tactical aerial warfare actions such as close air support or CAS, air-to-ground actions against hostile targets in close proximity of friendly forces.
Training good pilots is extremely important, and now with this homegrown jet trainer, we have technologically evolved significantly. This is considered a major step for our Air Force. The training period will now be shorter and more comprehensive.
Prior to this, jet pilot training was done outside Iran, and due to Western and U.S. sanctions, Iranian pilots could not receive training abroad.
We did ask for assistance, but no country in the world helped us. However, at the end of the day, it worked out for the best because we were able to develop the technology that we needed ourselves. Knowledge-based companies helped us a lot. In particular, I have to point out the design of the engine and also its aerodynamic design. All in all, Yasin is about 800 kilometers lighter than our first prototype, which is a significant achievement.
Iran started designing jet trainers over 10 years ago. Yasin is the second generation of a prototype that was unveiled in 2019. The new version now includes state-of-the-art avionics, engine, landing gear, and full cockpit devices.
With all the equipment installed, this training jet is fully equipped and it can be used for training pilots in all different levels.
But there's more to Yasin than just training fighter jet pilots.
It is also a question of prestige. This jet trainer was made by our own scientists and inventors. Knowledge-based companies played a very important part. Obviously, it means great economic benefits, but other than that, it shows that we can stand on our own feet. This is the most important message.
In the next 2 years, three more Yasin jet trainers will be produced based on the requirements of Iran's Air Force.
Iran has made great achievements in the field of aviation, and this is a symbol of self-sufficiency of the Islamic Republic. Gisumi Shah Ahmadi, Tehran.
Some breaking news now. Israeli forces have shot dead three more Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. This brings to 82 the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli soldiers and settlers in 2023. Let's cross over to the occupied West Bank and bring in our correspondent in Ramallah, Muna Kandil. Muna, what's the latest you're hearing on the ground about this latest murder?
The Israeli military issued a statement this morning saying that Israeli soldiers from the Golani Brigade had deployed near the Israeli military checkpoint of Surra, West Nablus, when there had been clashes between Palestinian fighters there and the Israeli soldiers at that area. They claimed that Palestinian fighters opened fire at Israeli soldiers and a military position there. And then the Israeli forces succeeded to murder three Palestinian fighters and wounded a fourth and had taken him for investigation. The identity of the four Palestinians, including the three who had been killed, had not been revealed yet. The Palestinian Ministry of Health didn't confirm if it's true three Palestinians had been killed or not. This is an Israeli military statement who confirmed that the Israeli soldiers killed the three Palestinians this morning near Nablus and wounded and arrested a fourth Palestinian there. Anyways, the Palestinians in the city of Nablus had declared a day of mourning there and a general strike, but the identity of the four Palestinians had not been revealed yet. As you have mentioned, today we are speaking about over 80 Palestinians had been killed by the Israeli forces since the beginning of 2023, including women, children, and Palestinian fighters. At the end of the day, every day Israeli forces raid Palestinian areas on a daily basis, arrest Palestinians, use their weapons in order to shoot and kill people in cold blood, even if there had been no resistance, no form of resistance or clashes in the area they raid.
Mona, thank you very much indeed for that. Mona Kandil there with the latest for joining us from the occupied West Bank. Now, thousands of Israeli protesters have hit the streets for the 10th consecutive week to express their anger at judicial reforms proposed by far-right cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Protesters insist they will continue to rally as long as the cabinet does not announce a freeze on the legislation. The organizers have vowed to intensify the demonstrations in the coming days. The protests turned into violence in Tel Aviv and elsewhere on several occasions. Netanyahu returned to power as the regime's prime minister in late December, heading a coalition of far-right and extremist parties. The proposed reforms would limit the Supreme Court's ability to rule against the cabinet's decisions. Elsewhere, China has named a general sanctioned by the U.S. as its new defense minister, as tensions remain high between the two sides. The Chinese parliament overwhelmingly approved Li Shangfu's nomination for the new cabinet. Li has been under U.S. sanctions since 2018 over the purchase of combat aircraft and equipment from Russia. The 65-year-old is an aerospace engineer and the son of a high-ranking army commander. His promotion follows a warning by the Chinese foreign minister that there will surely be conflict with the U.S. unless Washington changes course. China-U.S. relations are at their lowest in decades, with the two countries at odds over everything from trade to human rights to territorial issues. North Korea says it will take important practical war deterrence measures. The announcement was made at a ruling party meeting presided by the country's leader, Kim Jong-un. Pyongyang said that the move is aimed at coping with the present situation in which the war provocations of the U.S. and South Korea are reaching the red line. It did not provide the specifics on the measures. Seoul and Washington are scheduled to start their joint annual military exercises on Monday. The exercises have angered North Korea that views them as rehearsals for an invasion. France's Senate has approved the government's controversial pension reforms bill. This came hours after hundreds of thousands of protesters took to the streets across the country to oppose President Emmanuel Macron's unpopular plan. The bill was passed by the upper chamber of French Parliament by 195 votes to 112. Now it is another step closer to turning into law. Earlier on Saturday, scuffles broke out between French police and demonstrators protesting the bill. Protesters hurled rocks as police used the tear gas to disperse them in Paris. Similar demonstrations were held in other cities. The government seeks to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64, arguing it is the only way to prevent the collapse of the current system. And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
Thank you. the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
The Silicon Valley Bank and its nearly $175 billion in deposits have been put under government control It's the largest U.S. bank to fail since the 2008 financial crisis. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of CNBC has covered this story and tells us more. Financial regulators have closed Silicon Valley Bank and taken control of its deposits. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation announced on Friday, 10th of March, in what is the largest U.S. bank failure since the global financial crisis more than a decade ago. The collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, SVB, a key player in the technology and venture capital community, leaves companies and wealthy individuals largely unsure of what will happen to their money. According to press releases from regulators, the California Department of Financial Protection and Innovation closed Silicon Valley Bank and named the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation as the receiver. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, in turn, has created the Deposit Insurance National Bank of Santa Clara, which now holds the insured deposits from SVB. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation said in the announcement that insured depositors will have access to their deposits no later than Monday morning. SVB's branch offices will also reopen at that time under the control of the regulator. According to the press release, SVB's official checks will continue to clear. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation's standard insurance covers up to $250,000 per depositor per bank for each account ownership category. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation said uninsured depositors will get receivership certificates for their balances. The regulator said it will pay uninsured depositors an advance dividend within the next week, with potential additional dividend payments as the regulator sells SVB's assets. Whether depositors with more than $250,000 ultimately get all of their money back will be determined by the amount of money the regulator gets as it sells Silicon Valley assets, or if another bank takes ownership of the remaining assets. There were concerns in the technology community that until that process unfolds, some companies may have issues making payroll. At the end of December, SVB had roughly $209 billion in total assets and $175.4 billion in total deposits, according to the press release. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation said it was unclear what portion of those deposits were above the insurance limit. The last U.S. bank failure of this size was Washington Mutual in 2008, which had $307 billion in assets. Silicon Valley Bank was a major bank for the venture-backed companies, which were already under pressure due to higher interest rates and a slowdown for initial public offerings that made it more difficult to raise additional cash. The closure of Silicon Valley Bank, SVB, would impact not only the deposits but also credit facilities and other forms of financing. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation said loan customers of SVB should continue to make their payments as normal. The move represents a rapid downfall for SVB. On Wednesday, 8th of March, the bank announced it was looking to raise more than $2 billion in additional capital after suffering a $1.8 billion loss on asset sales. The shares of parent company, SVB Financial Group, fell 60% on Thursday, 9th of March, and dropped another 60% in pre-market trading on Friday, 10th of March, before being halted. CNBC's David Faber reported Friday morning that the efforts to raise capital had failed and that SVB had pivoted towards a potential sale. However, a rapid outflow of deposits was complicating the sale process. While many Wall Street analysts have argued that the struggles for Silicon Valley Bank are unlikely to spread to the broader banking system, shares of other mid-sized and regional banks came under pressure on Friday. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said during testimony before the House Ways and Means Committee on Friday morning that she was monitoring very carefully developments at a few banks. Janet Yellen made her comments before the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation's announcement. Shortly after leaving Capitol Hill, Janet Yellen convened a meeting of top officials at the Fed, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and the Comptroller of the Currency specifically to discuss the situation at the Silicon Valley Bank. The Associated Press has also covered the story and tells us more. Regulators rushed on Friday, 10th of March, to seize the assets of one of the Silicon Valley's top banks, marking the largest failure of a U.S. financial institution since the height of the financial crisis almost 15 years ago. Silicon Valley Bank, the nation's 16th largest bank, failed after depositors hurried to withdraw money this week amid anxiety over the bank's health. It was the second biggest bank failure in U.S. history after the collapse of Washington Mutual in 2008. The bank served mostly technology workers and venture capital-backed companies, including some of the industry's best-known brands. "This is an extinction-level event for startups," said Gary Tan, the chief executive officer of Y Combinator, a startup incubator that launched Airbnb, DoorDash, and Dropbox, and has referred hundreds of entrepreneurs to the bank. "I literally have been hearing from hundreds of our founders asking for help on how they can get through this. They're asking, do I have to furlough my workers?" There appeared to be little chance of the chaos spreading to the broader banking sector as it did in the months leading up to the Great Recession. The biggest banks, those most likely to cause an economic meltdown, have healthy balance sheets and plenty of capital. Nearly half of the U.S. technology and healthcare companies that went public last year after getting early funding from venture capital firms were Silicon Valley Bank customers, according to the bank's website. The bank also boasted of its connections to leading technology companies such as Shopify, ZipRecruiter, and one of the top venture capital firms, Andreessen Horowitz. Tan estimated that nearly one-third of Y Combinator's startups will not be able to make payroll at some point over the next month if they cannot access their money. Internet television provider Roku was among casualties of the bank collapse. It said in a regulatory filing on Friday that about 26% of its cash, or $487 million, was deposited at the Silicon Valley Bank. Roku said its deposits with Silicon Valley Bank were largely uninsured, and it didn't know to what extent it will be able to recover those funds. As part of the seizure, California bank regulators and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation transferred the bank's assets to a newly created institution, the Deposit Insurance Bank of Santa Clara. The new bank will start paying out insured deposits. On Monday, then, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and California regulators plan to sell off the rest of the assets to make other depositors whole. There was unease in the banking sector all week, with shares tumbling by double digits. The news of Silicon Valley Bank's distress pushed shares of almost all financial institutions even lower on Friday, 10th of March. The failure arrived with incredible speed. Some industry analysts suggested on Friday that the bank was still a good company and a wise investment. Meanwhile, Silicon Valley Bank executives were trying to raise capital and find additional investors. However, trading in the bank's shares was halted before stock market's opening bell due to extreme volatility. Shortly before noon, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation moved to shutter the bank. Notably, the agency did not wait until the close of business, which is the typical approach. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation could not immediately find a buyer for the bank's assets, signaling how fast depositors cashed out. The White House said Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen was watching closely what was happening at the bank. The administration sought to reassure the public that the banking system is much healthier than during the Great Recession. Our banking system is in a fundamentally different place than it was a decade ago, said Cecilia Roose, chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisers. Cecilia Roose added the reforms that were put in place back then really provide the kind of resilience that we'd like to see.
Choose to think better. Welcome to A Better You. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome back to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we look at a trending news story which has a direct relevance to the religion of Islam, and we break it down from a Muslim perspective. The favourite to become the next leader of Scotland, the Scottish Health Secretary, Hamza Yousaf, has caused a huge debate in the Muslim community by saying he believes that same-gender marriage is equal to heterosexual marriage, a position which Islam does not condone. So on today's show, we're going to discuss to what extent Muslim politicians should represent their faith in public life. Here's more context on the story.
A new issue has risen for Muslims living in the West. Politicians from a Muslim background compromising on Islam in order to further their political careers. The most recent example was seen in Scotland, with Scottish Nationalist Party leadership candidate Hamza Yousaf taking the un-Islamic position of supporting same-sex relationships when questioned by journalists about his religious stance.
Just to be crystal clear on this, do you think that gay sex is a sin?
Oh, look, I've answered this question time and time and time and time again. No matter how many times, Sophie, you ask the question, I believe in equal marriage. I believe that people's marriage, if they are gay and they are married, that their marriage is no less, is no more inferior or less, is worth less than my marriage as a heterosexual.
Other prominent examples of Muslim politicians abandoning Islamic norms include American Senator Ilhan Omar and British London Mayor Sadiq Khan, both of whom have been condemned by traditionalist Muslims for their pro-LGBT stances, among other controversial positions, including support for Israel and the Western war machine.
My name is Sadiq Khan. And now more so than ever before, I say it's with great pride, I am the Mayor of London!
Some argue that compromising is a necessary evil in order to gain Muslims political representation. However, Muslims in high office rarely ever champion issues of concern to the community, particularly Islamic positions, which are considered controversial according to Western worldviews. The issue can be so divisive between Muslims that some scholars now condone the opinion that Muslims should not engage in the democratic process of disbelieving nations. But the debate rages on.
Well, joining us in the studio today to talk about Muslims in public life, we have Lubaba Khalid, who is currently a Young Labour BME officer and previously was the Vice President of Welfare at the University of Westminster Student Union. Her work has centred on the attainment gap, decolonialisation of the university and anti-racism work. Lubaba, thank you so much for joining me on the show. Now, just tell me, what do you make of this story coming out of Scotland? It's obviously a difficult situation that Hamza Yusuf has been put in. It seems as if he's being focused on specifically because of his Muslim background.
That's the reality because, you know, he's running against another candidate who is a very strong Christian. I've now forgotten her name. Forbes, yeah. And she's a strong Christian and she was asked the same questions around, you know, gay sex and things like that. And she didn't get the same backlash as Hamza Yusuf. So one can only think that, can only come to the conclusion that the backlash that he's getting and the question that he's come is inherently from an Islamophobic position than it being about the politics that he's running on and the policies that he would like to see if elected.
It seems as if Muslims are in this rock and a hard place. They're kind of stuck where if they choose to stand by traditionalist Islamic interpretations, the kind of thing they would have been brought up to believe, then, of course, they'll become potentially persecuted. They won't be able to pursue mainstream careers, for example, like Hamza Yusuf. If he took a different position on this subject, I doubt he would have been treated so well. Mm-hmm. Even though he took a pro-Western viewpoint on this issue, he's still being grilled by the media. But I think with Forbes, the Christian alternative, she has taken some controversial positions as well from a mainstream position, but because, you know, she's white British, she's perhaps given the freedom to be controversial without this kind of like, well, her career's going to be completely destroyed as a result of that. Just tell me, as someone, as a Muslim yourself in this country who's, you know, getting involved in politics now, what's the atmosphere like for Muslims in the political sphere right now?
It's very hostile. It's hostile. It is a struggle to find the balance where we're not compromising our morals and our religion, but also wanting to create that change in society and things like that. So it is really tough. A lot of Muslim politicians that may have started off with the right politics and the right reasons and the right morals and things like that for now have been forced to accept these ideas that do contradict our religion. And we shouldn't be somewhat scared to say that. It is written in our scriptures. It is written. These things are not acceptable in Islam. But we're now in a situation where we're being forced to. But then the reality is this is not accepted in the three Abrahamic faiths as well. And I think people do forget that as well. So
it seems like, because this is obviously a secular country by and large, I think, you know, to describe as a Christian country right now is quite rich. Yeah. It's hard to find someone who identifies as a Christian these days. Yeah. So it seems as if there might be some kind of attack on religion. You mentioned quite rightly that this is a view that all the Abrahamic religions adhere to. It's not just Islam, but it seems as if anyone who is religious and pursues a public career, they can be demonized just for having those opinions, just for believing in their religion. And standing by those principles, they can be demonized. Do you think that that's the case?
I do. I feel like there is a more acceptance to attack Muslims than it would be for, let's say, Catholics or Jewish people.
Really?
I feel like there is a more acceptance that society has created with, you know, with 9/11 and the narrative around terrorism and things like that, that it's become a lot more acceptable to frame Muslims as extreme, as their religion being extreme, than it is for other religions. I think currently that's where we are right now in terms of yes, it might be something that's in within all three religions, but I feel like it's accepted now within society that you can be Islamophobic and you won't be challenged on it. So...
Well, for more on this subject, we've also been able to speak to the veteran journalist Yvonne Ridley, who is currently a national executive member of the ALBA party, which is a Scottish nationalist and pro-independence party. Let's see what she had to say.
Humza Yousaf has boxed himself into a corner at the moment on mixed marriage, and you have to wonder, well, he's sounding more like a career politician than a conviction politician. Whereas one of his rivals for the First Minister leadership is Kate Forbes, who is a committed Christian, but she's obviously, looking at her background, more of a conviction politician. She has come out, drawn her red lines. I will do this, I believe in this, but I will not agree to certain issues. At the end of the day, all of these politicians, regardless of whatever faith they hold, they are representing a mixed community, people of faith and people of no faith. And so in order to represent them fairly, they can't afford to have too many red lines that are going to upset certain religious or even non-religious sensibilities. Some people might think that Muslims are on a hiding to nothing because if they embrace the fortitude of Kate Forbes, who was quite adamant about her religious position on legislation, their critics would say, oh, this is Islamism coming into it. This politician is a fundamentalist, he's an extremist, he's dangerous. And of course, we all know in Britain that Islamophobia really is a very long word for racism. And unfortunately, we know that Britain, especially in the establishment, is institutionally racist. It's just there. So politicians from the Islamic faith, especially olive-skinned politicians, wouldn't be given the same latitude that Kate Forbes has been given. In fact, her rather obstinate position, non-negotiable position on same-sex marriages, has earned her a lot of respect, because she has stood by her guns. So it may be that her position to refuse to compromise anything that would affect her faith may actually serve her well in the end, because people do like politicians who are decisive. The danger is that Muslims will not engage, will withdraw into an Islamic bubble and not get involved in politics. And that is the last thing that we want to see. I have lived in Scotland now for more than 10 years and can see the difference between the Scottish communities and the English communities, Muslim communities. And the Scottish Muslims are very happy to wave the Scottish saltire, the blue and white flag, and celebrate the famous poet Robbie Burns, and celebrate St. Andrew's Day, which is the patron saint of Scotland. And they seem quite relaxed and able to do that. And, you know, Humza Yousaf, when he took his parliamentary oath, he swore on the Holy Quran while other ministers swore on the Bible. He swore on the Holy Quran. He was wearing a kilt in Islamic tartan. We have our own tartan in Scotland. And that message is so powerful. And what the message is saying is anyone, regardless of faith or skin colour, can take part in government. And this trickles down to kids who are looking up at these politicians and thinking, yeah, I can do that. Not just Muslims, Jews as well. Yeah. More than 40 Jewish Labour members have been, they've said, persecuted and hounded out of the party. Because since Keir Starmer arrived, we've now learned that there are two sets of Jews. There are good Jews who support Israel and are Zionists and are proud to say that they're Zionists. And then there are bad Jews who don't believe in Israel, are very hostile to human rights, abuses in Israel. And, of course, they're perceived to be bad Jews and have been thrown out of the party. With the exception, I think, of one who's decided to take legal action, and the Labour Party has apologised.
Well, before we continue the studio discussion, let's take a look at what people on the streets of London have to say about this. We spoke to two Muslims to give their issues on this particular subject.
Politicians like Sadiq Khan, who were elected on a basis that we're Muslim, should not go and compromise on their religion. I feel like if you're being elected on the basis of being a Muslim and you're representing a certain group of society, you shouldn't go against what they elected you on. And as a person who studies politics, it comes with democracy and representation as well. You're voted on a basis that people believe you're the person to put their ideas across, and once you start going against them, you shouldn't be in power.
Hi, everyone. My name is Itisham Salamikum. I'm a councillor for this area, so I'm at Wembley Hill. In the 5 years that I have been elected, I haven't actually been put into a position where I've had to compromise my principles. But not because of anything else other than we are believers in justice and equality, freedom and principles of empathy and compassion. The issue that's going on there, and I have differences, let's say. I'm trying to be diplomatic with those who have a stance on particularly the situation in Israel and Palestine, which is not right, I'll be honest. Our religion tells us not to kind of judge other people, but obviously in particular instances where we can have disagreements with them and we can have conversations, and I think that should be where we are allowed to have kind of differences of opinion, but at least we should have that conversation. If we stifle debate, then that is the point where they've already lost. If they want to stifle debate on certain issues and they're not open to having those conversations, then it shows like a lack of moral strength or intellectual integrity.
What about Baroness Wazi? Someone like her, did she compromise on her Islamic principles to remain in politics?
Irrespective of whichever party you are from, you need to make sure you don't compromise on your principles. And I know that she has done a lot trying to highlight the levels of Islamophobia that are present, again, not just within the Conservative Party, but across this country. We are still a racist, sexist, misogynistic kind of country, an old imperial, colonial kind of country. We still have the remnants of that. So in terms of what she has doing, it's positive that she is highlighting it. But if she's the lone voice, and let's be honest, the Tory party are so right-wing now that they are painting Muslims as the enemy. If she is a lone voice in that battle, then she can only do so much. Again, I'm trying to be as diplomatic as possible. I don't agree with a lot of what, again, she stands, she's a member of a party that I totally and vehemently disagree with. But in terms of her as a person, as an individual, if she is the only person that's doing it...
Well, there you have it. Plenty of views we've heard on this issue now. Now, obviously, the LGBT issue in Scotland is not the only example of where Muslims have entered into politics in the West, and it appears as if they've had to compromise from one degree or another. Other areas would be, say, on the Palestinian issue, the Palestinian cause. It seems like London Mayor Sadiq Khan has expressed a great interest in going to visit Israel, for example, and is very happy to do so, in his view. Ilhan Omar in the US, a Muslim senator, has voted for resolutions which are branded as pro-Israel as well, and also support for Western wars, that type of thing. So just tell me where you stand on this, Lubaba, because obviously I think most Muslims, if not all, would say that these are red line issues. We shouldn't be compromising on Palestine and other issues.
So, in context, my mother is Palestinian, so Palestine is something I will never compromise on. I can't, because that is my identity. One thing I will never understand is when someone compromises on seeing the oppressed, because we know in Islam it is our responsibility as an ummah, as a community, to stand on the side of the oppressed. And that should not be controversial. That shouldn't be something that is striving debate or what did the guy say that the previous on the video where, you know, having to be diplomatic about it. Personally, I don't think we do, not on something like Palestine, especially in something like Palestine, something that's happening right now in China with the Uyghur Muslims. Syria is another example. These are issues that, no, we don't need to be diplomatic about. We should be very clear that we will stand on the side of the people that are constantly being murdered on a daily basis, that their land is being taken away from. And that's what Islam tells us to do as well. And so I get very agitated, I get frustrated, obviously as a Muslim, but I think it's mainly as a Palestinian, when I see that people get elected on the oppression of my people and then they get elected and they throw it all away. And to be fair, this is not something that I've just seen among Muslims. You see it among the white left as well, that will talk about Palestine, will be openly talk about it, but then as soon as they get into their positions, they forget about it all. And so, yeah.
Do you think then, in that case, that there is an issue here? Because, as you said, when Muslims get into politics, not talking about yourself here, but other candidates, when they get high-ranking levels in politics, they are expected to compromise on this. To be pro-Palestine, as we saw with Jeremy Corbyn, for example, can get you in a lot of hot water. So they may opt to go for a more mainstream opinion on it, which is to be impartial, if not basically pro-Israel on the subject.
Then what's the point of being in? What's the point of going up in ranks? What is the point? Then that's the question we have to ask ourselves then. Should we be encouraging Muslim representation in politics, in positions, to get them in positions of power, like, for example, Sadiq Khan as the current mayor, if that will not benefit us in any way or form and it then leads to compromise, then genuinely, and it's a question that I feel like we do need to ask ourselves, that should we be asking for that representation? Because is it not worse then? Because then what happens is that you have Muslims who are in positions of these positions of power, you could say, who've compromised on their views. And then there's an expectation now for any Muslim who decides to go into those positions of power to also compromise. So then the question really is, what's the point?
It
sounds very harsh, but that's the question we have to ask ourselves. Then is there a point in encouraging Muslim representation in the current political sphere that we're in?
Do you think that we actually have Muslim representation at the moment?
No, I actually, and again, this is, I actually believe we have socialist representation who just happen to be Muslim, who just happen to be people of colour. But I think it's a very pick and choose for a lot of Muslims. Like, I understand me, and, you know, one thing we are taught in Islam is not to assume what a person's going through.
Yeah.
But I do recognise they are under a lot of pressure, an enormous amount of pressure. I do recognise that. But at the same time, it really depends on the individual. If they were elected on the basis that they were Muslim before their politics, then you have an expectation and you have a responsibility to represent being a Muslim in its whole, and you can't pick and choose when to give things up and when to, you know, do that. But if you were elected on socialist policies or Tory policies or whatever it is, but then you just happen to be Muslim, then that's a different ball game altogether in terms of that discussion. But when you, and I think that's where the conversation with Sadiq Khan comes into account, is that he did play on that Muslim card. He played on being a son of a bus driver to get votes, to then get elected and not actually do anything for that community he claimed to, that he was serving. That's where the problem comes.
For sure. I appreciate your time. Of course, this situation is ongoing, so we'll have to see how it develops. But we have reached the end of the show. But thank you very much, Rebaba, for appearing with us. And thank you to everyone at home for watching as well. This is another edition of Eye on Islam that's successfully come to an end. But don't worry, we'll be back next week for another edition of the show. But for now, assalamu alaikum.
The Limelight.
The German authorities have searched a ship thought to have possibly transported explosives tied to the Nord Stream pipeline explosions, the German prosecutor's office said on Wednesday, 8th of March. The announcement came following media reports indicating pro-Ukrainian groups may have been responsible for the blasts. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newsletter The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The underwater bombing of the Nord Stream gas pipelines last September was carried out by a team of divers operating from a 15-metre chartered yacht called the Andromeda, according to a new report. The report in the German magazine Der Spiegel traces the Andromeda